Before we get started, a slight apology. All of my headcasts have been delayed due to family, the holidays. I apologize for that. I'm working on getting it back on a schedule of some sort. But here is episode 28 of Task Force X. As soon as I can, I will get things back on schedule. But never fear, the headcasts haven't disappeared, just been delayed. Without further ado, here is episode 28 of Task Force X, where I talk about the first two issues of the Deadshot miniseries.
Behold the voice of God.
For those of you who don't know me officially, my name is Amanda Waller.
And I am Aaron Moss, your host of Task Force X.
What, are we some kind of suicide squad?
Well, yeah, that and...
Checkmate.
Task Force X is a podcast that tells the stories of John Ostrander's Suicide Squad and Paul Kupperberg's Checkmate from the late 80s, early 90s.
I want to build a team of some bad people who can do some good.
And that's what Suicide Squad is. While Checkmate is a team of good people doing some good, my mission here is to chronicle each and every title in all the books that Suicide Squad and Checkmate appeared in during that era.
We're the U.S. government. You're going to start a blog and expose us?
Well, a blog and a headcast, Amanda.
Those scumbags are trying to screw me.
Not at all, Amanda. Just trying to help everyone else discover the joy of the Suicide Squad and Checkmate. Anywho, hope you guys have as much fun with these comics as I did when I first read them, oh, so many years ago. That's enough of that, Amanda. Let's go ahead and start the show.
I didn't believe the stories.
Nobody does.
Remember, I'm watching.
I see everything.
And welcome back. Let's go ahead. And this month, we're going to skip the Suicide Squad and Checkmate reviews. And we're going to do a review of the first two issues of the Deadshot miniseries from 1988. Next month, we'll look at the issues 3 and 4. This miniseries happens to coincide right around with the Suicide Squad 1920, right in that time frame. They make a mention in, I think it was issue 19 or 18, they make a mention about Deadshot taking some time off for personal reasons, and also they make a mention about Marine Hers also taking some personal time. This is where this fits into. That's why I'm reviewing it at this point. So let's go and take a look at the first issue of the Deadshot miniseries. This was cover dated November of 1988, but the actual on sale date was July the 19th of 1988. Again, just personally, telling my own personal experience into this. That was my summer after I graduated from high school, before I started the 1 year college I went to. This cost $1. The editor was Robert Greenberger. The title was Die But Once. The writer was John Ostrander and Kim Yell. The artist, Luke McDonald. Letterer, Timothy Harkins. Colorist, the ever-busy Juliana Fritter. And the cover was by artist Luke McDonald. And this was reprinted in the Deadshot Beginnings trade paperback, which came out in 2013. Our story starts with a redhead trying to deliver a message to Floyd Lawton at his address. The landlord tells her that this address is just a message drop, to which he forwards to a P.O. box. We find out that this woman is Floyd's ex-wife, Susan. We then meet up with Floyd as he meets someone named Silage. That's in quotes. After the two men get caught up on the fate of the previous crew, which are all dead, Silage takes Floyd to meet the guy looking to hire him as a hitter. Watching the duo leave is Rick Flagg and Sergeant Steele. Steele tells Rick that Floyd's chances of making out are slim. Rick explains that Floyd likes the suicide missions. He's waiting for someone to kill him. But then we see Maureen Hers as she looks over Deadshot's file and recounts his origin. We find out that Floyd comes from a rich family. At a party, Batman stopped an attempted robbery, inspiring Floyd. He puts on a costume with top hat and tails, and he becomes a hero, in quotes. Batman soon proved that Floyd was actually running a con and was actually leading a gang. Floyd found himself in jail. When he got out, he donned the Deadshot costume that we're familiar with the wrist magnums and everything, and went hunting for Batman, which caused him to get sent back to jail repeatedly. The last time he was in, he was visited by Flag and Bronze Tiger, who offered him a job with the Suicide Squad. Then there's a reference to the Justice League Suicide Squad crossover that I talked about back in episode 23 with Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast. Hey, Paul, thanks again for appearing and talking with me about that issue. Anyways, Maureen thinks to herself about Floyd and why he seems to have this death wish. We then cut back to Floyd, meeting with a guy called Aristotle. Aristotle tells Deadshot that to meet the boss, he has to pass a test. A man is dragged in, and Deadshot is informed that this man works for the government, and Deadshot must kill the traitor. Without hesitation, Deadshot blows him away. In the van outside, Steel tells Flag that Aristotle was lying, and they didn't have any men in the area. Flag says that Deadshot couldn't have known, and it would have made a difference anyways. Aristotle, after freaking out that Deadshot did it right away, says that they recorded him killing the man, and if he doesn't work for El Jefe, they would send the tape to authorities. Deadshot kind of chuckles and tells them to go for it. They can add to their collection. Aristotle tells Deadshot that he passed the test, and he meets the man in about 6 months to a year. Deadshot tells him that he's going to walk. If Jefe is the same as the mooks he's been dealing with, he's just going to walk away from this whole thing. Aristotle buckles and says that Deadshot can meet the Jefe tonight. We'll go back to Maureen, reading Floyd's file still. Floyd had difficulties relating to women. There's mention of Floyd being married and having a son. Dr. LaReeve comes in and says that she's off Deadshot's case as she's getting too personally involved. Maureen says that she's taking a leave of absence. That as a doctor, they need to be personally involved with their patients. I think he means a different way, and she's ignoring how she's personally involved, but we'll get to that back later. Meanwhile, Deadshot boards a plane to meet with El Jefe. Before he does, he tosses his wiretap. Once the plane takes off, he meets Jefe. Once he meets Jefe, he kills Jefe and his entire crew. He tells Silage, right before he kills him, that he was the last one left alive from the old crew that he needed to kill. During the battle, the plane is damaged, and Floyd is sucked out, only to be saved by Black Orchid. Waller is happy that Jefe is dead, no matter how it happened. Waller tells Floyd that she has another mission, but he tells her that he's taking some personal time off. The end of the first issue. And now for my thoughts on this issue. As usual, we start with the cover. It's kind of a plainish cover. It says, from the pages of Suicide Squad, Deadshot. Beginnings. It tells us it's a 4-issue miniseries by Oster Yale McDonald. The cover itself, in the background, if you will, it's got a huge blocky number one. Inside the image, we see Deadshot with his wrist magnums pointed at Batman. One of the previous encounters. Below that, we see Deadshot walking across the panel, or across the page. As far as covers go, I'm going to call it a decent cover. I really like it, but the image of Batman's a little wonky. The Deadshot that's inside the numbers looks a little off. Meanwhile, the Deadshot that's walking across the page, that's a great interpretation of him. That's a great image. And I remember these covers. I'm pretty sure that all four of these issues, each one has the number of the issue. This one's got one, next one has two, and these blocky letters with an image in it, and then with an image of Deadshot in the front of it. So again, like I say, with Batman being and Deadshot being kind of wonky within the picture, it makes it so it's not a great cover, but it's still a good cover. That, again, I remember these covers. Deadshot in the foreground is a great picture. Overall, it's a good cover. And we go on to the first page, which shows Deadshot firing his wrist magnums. Off to the side is Maureen Hers. Behind him is like broken glass or something that's shattered, and there's images of three people in the images. And again, as I said, this issue is drawn by Luke McDonald, the same man who gives us the wonderful Suicide Squad monthly book at the time. So again, no matter what else I have to say about the story, from my previous talks about the Suicide Squad book, you know I'm going to enjoy the artwork. And so we, like I said in the synopsis, we start out And again, we have this redhead, short-haired woman who's looking for Floyd, wants to leave a note for him. And we find out that, again, I forget, since I know all this, how much we found in the book already. But here it's confirmed that he has an ex-wife. And again, it's just a little prelude to the actual story. Then we get to the main crux of the story itself, where Floyd is talking with this big black guy in chains, open shirt, very 80s looking. Nothing else, like I say, this guy, Floyd keeps calling him Silage, and he keeps correcting Floyd, saying it's Silas. Like, you never could get that clear, rich boy. And there's a little gel humor here as Silas sits down. He tells Floyd that, you know, you're looking good, Lutton. Almost as good as you looked to me in that place. And Floyd's like, didn't know your taste was still bent that way, Silage. You know, Silas, you never could get that clear, rich boy. Nah, I'm straight. Now in the place, you know, you can take what you can get. But outside, well, there's a world of opportunity. And so it throws back that, you know, again, never been to prison myself. But it throws back the old stereotype that when you're in prison, there's apparently prison gay and regular gay. Not to get on a tangent, not to diss anybody, but to me, gay's gay. Until I end up in prison, I guess I'll never know. But to me, gay is gay, and I don't see myself going that way, whether I'm in prison or not. Always, you know, never mind. I'm going to make another comment, but Trinket is family friendly. So, and again, so they're catching up, and apparently Silas, again, like the fact that Deadshot keeps calling him Silas throughout without missing a beat. That apparently Silas just got out of jail, so he's getting caught up on all the guys, and apparently out of the old crew, him and Floyd's the only one that's left alive. And I guess I can say without spoiling things, I think I already spoiled it in the synopsis, that, again, this whole part, it's a dual mission, if you will. Part of it is to get at the El Jefe, the bad guy, but then apparently Floyd has his own mission to apparently get rid of Silas, as Silas is the last of the old gang. It's never been exactly clear why Floyd's taking out all the old gang, other than just type loose ends. But again, we find out that this whole story is, again, as I've talked about in the synopsis, part of it's setting up Marine Her to find out about Deadshot's past. And this other part of the story is basically just to show us some of Deadshot's character and what a badass he is. So as he's trying to make nice with Silas and get in and find the leader, we see Sarge Steel and Rick Flag sitting outside in surveillance mode watching him. Steel's like, your man's pretty cool, Flag. And Flag's, my man's a creep, Steel. He's our best shot at El Jefe. And Steel tells Flag that the odds of Floyd making out are none too good. And again, this is where Flag tells us that, and I think we've referenced a little bit in the main series, but this is where we get more into Floyd's death wish. He tells him that if they were good, Lloyd wouldn't take the assignment. He's waiting for someone to put a bullet in his brain. And again, over the course of the story, we'll find a little more about Floyd and where he came from and why. That's what this whole miniseries is about. Speaking of Floyd and where he came from, the next page or two here is where we see Marnie Harris, and she's looking through Floyd's file. And again, we see pictures of supposedly mom and dad, or maybe just Floyd is some high society chick. But I think it's supposed to be mom and dad, because the panel next to us, or the caption next to us, talking about, you know, the scion of a wealthy family, father's based money in real estate, mother from the pit bankers, and so forth. And as I talked about all this during the synopsis, I'll go this laid out. Again, we start out with a shot of Bell Rev, and then we get a shot of Maureen Hurst sitting in her chair looking at her file, and then we see a bunch of pictures with Maureen narrating what's going on. And with, like I said, we get Floyd's backstory, how he came from a rich family. We see Batman stopped a robbery. Supposedly this inspired him to become a hero himself. And Batman exposed him as actually as a con man, which caused him to go back and forth into the Slammer. I like the way, I mean, they could have took a couple of pages and told this as a flashback story, but I like the way they kind of wrap it all up in a page and a half. And there's usually, you know, like the case files, they have pictures with Maureen narrating what's going on. I think it's a fine use of, like I say, try and get the story told, and without it, I mean, the Floyd's backstory is the focus of this little miniseries, but I like the way that they don't, and again, maybe I'm in the minority, but they don't do a full flashback story to tell us how Floyd got from point A to point B. They give us a brief little point here. They show pictures to highlight it. They even have his original costume, which is a top hat and tails. In fact, if you guys are on Facebook, back when the Suicide Squad movie came out, people were making comparisons to the way the squad looks in the movie to the comic book counterparts. And most pictures I saw had this version of Deadshot, which is really pre-Deadshot. Because he said, I mean, after that, he redesigned his costume, got the wrist magnums, and became the Deadshot we all know and love. Well, I know and love him. I think Deadshot's a great character, and his costume, at least, and I don't know, maybe it's just me, I like this version of his costume. The newer mask has got too many lines. In fact, a lot of the newer Heroes costumes, since the refit, New 52 and Rebirth and all that, a lot of their costumes has a lot more lines, a lot more stuff on it. I like the sleeker, the when I say Floyd's mask, it's just a white face mask with the telescopic lens on the eye. I think it's a lot cleaner than what he uses nowadays, but what do I know? And then we get the conversation between him and Rick Flagg from back before Legends, or actually during Legends 3 or whatever it was, Secret Origins 14, somewhere in there, where Flagg talks to Floyd and convinces him to sign up with the Suicide Squad, mainly on the basis of the name of the team alone, Suicide. And then we get an appearance from when Batman invaded Bell Rev back in issue 10. I forget, it may have been the Justice League International crossover in issues 13 of both books, but when Batman faces off Floyd and Batman tells him that, you know, if you would have shot me, you would have by now. Aren't you aware that you pull your shots around me? I like the way they're examining Deadshot in the way that, I mean, again, he's supposed to be the perfect assassin, never misses. But when he goes against Batman, you can't have him killing Batman, so of course he's going to miss. So I like the way how they're examining how come he misses when he's around Batman. Like, it's a nice little examination of the mind and psyche of Floyd Lawton. Then over on page 10, Floyd's talking with Aristo, who is apparently Hefe's right-hand man. And Aristo tells him that we've got this guy that we think is a spy. Kill him. And again, Aristo's thinking that Deadshot will take him out back or take him elsewhere and kill him, but just right there, just Deadshot uses his magnums, just blows the guy's brains out. I guess it shows that Deadshot does what Deadshot feels he needs to do. He doesn't care, again, about anything. And then when Aristo tells him that, you know, it looks like you're going to be working for us, we're going to send this to the police. Deadshot's like, he points his wrist magnums at Aristo and says, so what, they can add to the collection. Who do you think you're messing around here? Some penny-any mook like silage over there? I'm Deadshot, I'm bored of these games. And like Rick has said, and Maureen Herz has said, that Deadshot appears to have a death wish. So he's got all these guys pointing guns at him, and most people would kind of back off a little bit. Deadshot's like, you know what? Go ahead. You shoot me, I'll shoot this guy. It don't matter to me. And Deadshot, to me, is very much... Actually, he came first, but he's very much like Martin Riggs from the... at least the early... Lethal Weapon movie. He's kind of a nut, whereas Riggs was a cop. Deadshot is very much a bad guy, but he's got that death wish, which makes him good at what he does, because he doesn't let fear of death that stops most of us from doing things. It doesn't bother Deadshot. He's like, go ahead and shoot me. I don't care. And he's back a little bit on page 10 after he shoots the, in quotes, traitor, the government guy. Sergeant's like, not one of our guys. We didn't have anyone in this area. And Flag's like, it doesn't really matter. Deadshot couldn't have known, wouldn't have known. Doesn't care. Basically, Deadshot would have killed the guy whether he was a government spy or not. Which, again, as I was just saying, Deadshot is a bad guy. Even though he is working for the good guys, he does things his way. Which, one of the things that makes Deadshot really cool, the fact that... I think that's what I didn't really pay the other time reading this book again, but... I think one thing I like about The Lethal Weapon, at least I see the first movie or two, is that Riggs has lost his wife, and he's very suicidal. He still wants to be a good cop, but he does what he feels he needs to do, and he doesn't really let things like his safety get in the way. Riggs and Deadshot are very much alike in that regard. In fact, they're pretty much this, different sides of the same coin. One's a good guy, one's a bad guy, but they both have this death wish. They both are willing to do whatever it takes to get the job done. And so after Deadshot proves himself, Russell tells him it could be 6 months or a year before he meets the boss. And Deadshot's like, you know what? I'm out of here. If I can't meet the boss sooner, I gotta meet the guy to make sure he's not, you know, a loser like you guys. Again, very Deadshot-like, just to tell him like it is. Tell him, you know what? I'm willing to walk away. And then we get some more of Maureen flashing back, thinking about her and Floyd's little conversation. And apparently how Floyd has difficulties relating to women. Anyone that follows Deadshot should know that, though. And brings up about it. He had a son that he doesn't talk about. And again, as I said, Deadshot is a bad guy, in quotes. He's suicidal. But from his conversation here... He still seems to care about his wife and son. And again, this was changed for the movie. Well, actually, I say it was changed for the movie, but I forget now. It's been a while. Here he has a wife or ex-wife and son. There was another miniseries down the road a decade or so. And I want to say there he had a daughter. But I know in the movie, the Suicide Squad movie that just came out, they gave him a daughter and a wife. So... Or ex-wife, I'm not sure their status, but... Anyways, enough about that. Let's keep on with the story. I do like when he's talking, during this flashback, Floyd's talking with Maureen. And he's like, I was raised rich. Saw women marry guys for the bucks, and then divorced them and took them all they could. Real pros make you pay once, not all your life. So again, so through his various experiences with women, he equates all women as being hookers, basically. And he's basically, you know, says hookers only make you pay once, but wives, if you will, make you pay for the rest of your life. Which I have known people like that has that attitude. Not a very healthy attitude to have, but it's one that Floyd apparently has. And further, when they're talking... he tells Maureen, hell, you're a pro too. All this caring is what you're paid to do. You're just another pro. And she slaps him. They kiss. And Dr. LaGreve is basically calling her on the carpet saying that should have never happened. It should never got to that point where they kissed. That she's losing her professional detachments. And so she takes a leave of absence, which brings us up to current time with her looking into Floyd's background. And again, and she says here, to help professional objectivity, let's try compassion for once in our careers and make the efforts to look further into Floyd's past. The missing piece is there and I can find it. So, I mean, I don't know how much of this is her caring for her patient and how much of this is her caring for Floyd. And as LaGreve says, she may have taken it too far and moved it from a professional standing to a more intimate, a more personal relationship. Which, again, I have to agree, even though she may have the best intentions, and it's hard to say what's in our heart, LaGreve is right. As a doctor, you need to stay professional and, I want to say, detached. I mean, you need to care for your patient, but there's a difference between caring for the patient and what Maureen Hers has for Deadshot. And then, as I talked about, we skip over to the Deadshot getting the plane to meet the big bad guy, El Jefe. And again, there's a note here at the bottom of page 16 where we see Deadshot ditching the comm. And Steel and Flag is talking, and he's like, Steel says that, he's talks about the microphone, and Steel wonders if it's because Deadshot plans on really joining El Jefe. And as they take off, like I said, they meet him, and El Jefe is like, you can't do nothing to me here. The cabin is pressurized, one stray shot, one tiny hole in the fuselage, we would all die, yourself included. Deadshot, I like Deadshot. And again, this last page where he says, El Jefe's like, yourself included. Deadshot's like, so? That panel there we see through Deadshot's eye lens. So the target's on El Jefe, it's all red. And the next page here on the top of page 18, after he says that, everyone looks like, oh, is he serious? Would he really do that? And then Deadshot pulls his wrist magnums and, well, he really does that. He shoots El Jefe. Actually, not one of Jefe's guys, I guess. He starts shooting everybody up. He kills El Jefe. And as I commented in the synopsis, I mean, we see Aristo, whatever his name is, fly out of the plane. And this is what I was talking about in the synopsis where he tells Silage, or Silas, that he was the only one left. The only one with the old gang I couldn't find. Which goes back to the earlier conversation when Deadshot was saying how, so-and-so is dead, so-and-so died. So this whole conversation, I say conversation, it's Deadshot monologuing, tells us that he killed all these other guys. And Deadshot seemed to set this whole thing up from what this panel here insinuates just to get the Silas. And he was able to take out El Jefe at the same time. And here on page 20, it's a little confusing. Deadshot's floating in the plane. I think he's reloading his wrist magnum. He fires at something. I'm assuming it's the plane itself. There's an explosion. So I don't know if it's the bullet he puts in his gun, his wrist magnums, or what. But the plane explodes. He goes flying out, and as I said, Black Orchid catches him. And I'm not quite sure if it's just the decompression of the plane that's already being decompressorized, or if he pets some exploding ammunition in his gun. I'm not quite sure what happened there. But then Black Orchid catches him, and she's like, mission's completed. Or is that Deadshot? It's kind of hard to tell here. One of them's like, mission's completed. Let's go see what old Mammy Waller has in mind for us next. And I think that's Black Orchid probably, because as we find out here, maybe Deadshot, because Deadshot gets back and Waller's happy. If it's dead, doesn't matter how it happened. Deadshot gets a letter from Flo from his dead drop, which we know is the note from his ex-wife. And Amanda says there's some more business he needs to tend to. And Floyd says, God without me, I'm taking some time off. And Waller's like, only personal business you got with me, only personal business you got time for now is my business. You can't leave. And Floyd's like, watch me. I've served my time. I go on missions when I feel like it. Right now, I don't feel like it. The end. Well, be continued. Next, suffer the child. And so again, I mean, Waller's one that stood up to the Batman, stared him down, and again, as in that Arkham cartoon animated movie, where Boomerang's like, you know, Waller, how crazy the Batman, how crazy the Joker. Floyd's willing to go up against her, so. Again, as he says here, he only does missions when, you know, he wants to. He served his time already. He's done his missions, if you will. So he's going off to his own personal mission, which we will find out about next. Hold on for another advertisement from some more fellow podcasters. And then we'll be back with the second issue of the Deadshot miniseries. Hold tight.
We'll be back after this break. Don't touch that dial, for goodness sake.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
Hi, I'm Tim from Cord Industries, the Blue Beetle blog. I'm here to tell you about an exciting new addition to the Silver and Gold family of podcasts. The show is Beatlemania, and it focuses on what is arguably one of the greatest superheroes in all of comics history, Blue Beetle. From the adventures of Dan Garrett the cop in the 1930s to Dan Garrett the archaeologist in the 1960s, from everyone's favorite Ted Kord to the more recent adventures of Jaime Reyes, we'll be covering the entire legacy of the Blue Beetle, and I won't be doing it alone. Joining me for this epic journey through the lives of the Blue Beetle will be Jay from the Silver and Gold Podcast. Together, we'll be discussing, reviewing, and celebrating the awesomeness of all of the Beatles. Beatlemania, coming soon to sngpod.com and cordindustries.blogspot.com.
He has been challenged to read all the comics he has collected. This podcast will summarize, review, and reminisce about a single comic book issue and the time period somewhat chronologically by release date. He keeps a stack of comics near his bedside for when the time is right. Who is this interesting comic fan and what is the podcast? Hello, my name is Pat. I don't normally do podcasts about the comic books I read, but when I do, I podcast about them on The Longbox Crusade. Listen to it on iTunes, Stitcher, or on TheLongboxCrusade.com, and check out the Facebook page. Read them all, my friends.
Here we go back to the show. That's the fact, so now you know.
And there was a couple of promos for a couple of great shows. Well, honestly, I can't say the great shows. I haven't heard the Beatlemania yet. It hasn't came out yet. But I know the guys that's doing it are great guys. They're coming some great Blue Beetles, so it's got to be a great show. And Pat Sampson, I've had him on my G.I. Joe show. I listened to his Longbox Crusade. It's a great show. He pulls out comics from his past. I believe Izzy bought them. And he reads them, reviews them, and gives his thoughts on them. Again, Pat's a great guy. That's a great show. I can definitely recommend his show. And I'm pretty sure, in fact, I give you a money-back guarantee on the Beatlemania that it's going to be a great show also. So, since it's free, I don't got to worry about anything on that. But, but no, I'm sure that Beatlemania is a great show. I'm going to listen to it when it comes out myself. So I definitely recommend checking out Beatlemania when it comes out. As slow as I record these podcasts right now, it may be out now. Who knows? Anyways, speaking of shows, let's get back to Task Force X, where I'm looking at the second episode. I said second episode again. The second issue of Deadshot. This one was cover dated December of 1988, but it came on sale August the 23rd of 1988. The price was $1, edited by Robert Greenberger. The title was Suffer the Child, written once again by the wonderful John Ostrander and Kim Yell, the husband-wife writing duo. Artist was Luke McDonald, the same artist from the regular series, The Suicide Squad. Letter was Timothy Harkins. Colorist was still Juliana Freder. And the cover artist was once again Luke McDonald. And yes, this was reprinted in the Deadshot Beginning Straight paperback from 2013. And the synopsis for this issue. This issue starts with Floyd knocking on the door of his ex-wife. We find out that he wanted her to move and change her name, but she refuses to give up on Floyd. Floyd says that he's there to find out what happened to their son. Susan, his ex-wife, says that someone took their son and that she got a phone call saying that Floyd needs to finish the job he started 20 years ago. Floyd promises Suze that he'll deal with the issue his way. We then cut to a room where we see little Ed, along with a man named Wes. Another guy named Danny comes in and tells Wes that he's not supposed to be in the same room with the boy. From the conversation, we get that Wes likes little boys a little too much. Kind of Catholic priests do. We then see Maureen arriving in town where the Lawtons live. She introduces herself to Floyd's dad and tells him that she's Floyd's therapist and she's trying to help him. His dad tells her that both of his sons are dead. He tells Maureen that she needs to stay out of their business or he'll have the sheriff kill her. Sheriff Trescott then escorts Maureen out. The sheriff, named Joe Trescott, takes her a cup of coffee and he gives her some answers just to get her out of town. Meanwhile, at the offices of Philip Shell, Deadshot shows up demanding to know where his son is. Shell tells him that his son was safe for the moment, and that to get the kid back, Deadshot needs to finish the job he started 20 years ago. Shell tells Deadshot that if Deadshot kills him, then the boy dies. If Deadshot goes looking for the boy, then they're going to give him to Uncle Wes. Deadshot makes Shell pet his hands on the desk and shoots him through both hands and tells him that he's playing games with the wrong man. Meanwhile, Maureen is talking with the sheriff about Lawton's history. She finds out that his mother moved out and still lives on the property in the little house. They never got divorced, and she never sees anyone. We also find out about Edward Robert Lawton. He was 3 years older than Floyd and was the golden boy. Good at sports, books, girls, etc. While Floyd was the opposite. We then find out that good old Ed was murdered by a sniper. Someone shot the dad in the spine, and then when Ed went to protect his dad, he got a bullet right between the eyes. The sheriff insinuates that Ed might have been the sniper, as it was a hell of a shot, and then right after that, when he started calling himself Deadshot. At the hospital, a cop is questioning Shell about his attacker. Shell is claiming he doesn't know who did it. After the cop leaves, Shell talks with his lawyer and tells him to contact Danny and have him move the boy to the alternate location. Also to release the black sniper, that Panther guy. As Shell is leaving, he's confronted in the parking lot by Floyd. When Floyd confronts or threatens him, Haskell gives up the boy's location. And to prevent Haskell from calling and warning the two knuckleheads that Deadshot's coming, he shoots Haskell and takes his car. Back at the safe house, Panther, which was that Panther guy, that black Panther guy, gets ready for Floyd while Danny and Wes take Ed away in the car, with Wes saying, "What a nice boy you are," and stroking Ed's hair. To be continued. Now, for my thoughts on this issue. Again, the cover starts out. It's got the big number 2 on the front. Again, we've got Deadshot kind of bending over, running across the foreground. In the big number 2, as I talked about, we've got an image from the actual comic with Deadshot shooting Shell's hands, as I mentioned. This time, my opinion on the cover is reversed. The foreground image of Deadshot's not quite as detailed. I don't know if it's just this. I have to pull mine now. I've got mine in the garage. Looking at this as a digital reprint on my computer right now, or digital scan. But here, Deadshot in the foreground, the costume's good, but the face is ill-defined. In fact, it looks kind of like a heat signature almost. Well, that's what he's going for, or what happened. But the image itself in the number 2, the background image, if you will, is much better than the previous issue. This, of course, is Deadshot. It's clearly Deadshot. It's a very good image. I like this cover. I don't know. I like it better, but the last one, I like the foreground image better. This one, I like the background within the number 2 better. So I think it's a bit of a toss-up. They're both good covers, but they both got their issues. The other one, the background image of Batman and Deadshot was a little rushed, I'm going to say. And this one here, Deadshot, I don't know if it's supposed to be a... Again, I don't know. Because it's just his head that looks like that. Like I say, it looks like a heat image. The red for his monocle at, or his eyes at. It's like a little red splotch. The rest of his mask is various shades of gray. I don't know. Overall, it's a good cover. I like all the covers. They're very distinctive. But just that little minor... If the mask could actually look like Deadshot's mask all the way, like it is in the background image, I would have liked this image a whole lot better. And this would have been my best cover, my favorite cover so far. But seeing how it's a little vague and... I don't know. Anyways, moving on to the story itself. Again, as the first page, we get some, I want to say, scenes from the book itself. The top one, we see this black guy holding a sniper rifle, which we find out is the Panther. We see Deadshot in a trigger thing, or a scope, which we can assume is Panther aiming at him. And below that, we see pictures of, I believe that's Shell. I believe it's supposed to be Little Ed and Wes. Anyways. again, this is another good page. Again, the artwork in this is by Luke McDonald. I have heard some people disparage Luke McDonald. Maybe in a four-color superhero book, it may not be that great. But for the Suicide Squad and Deadshot, this miniseries, I think Luke McDonald does a magnificent job on these books. I'm sure there could be some other good artists on it, but to my personal opinion, Luke McDonald is probably one of the best Suicide Squad / Deadshot artists. I think he conveys a really... And again, I don't like saying this with comic books, but it fits here. He has a real humanistic, a real realistic art feel to it, which I think works in these books. So we start the story out, as I said, Floyd knocking on his ex-wife's door. They're reunited. Again, she kind of tries to give him a hug. And Floyd's very Floyd, very professional. He gets on her, tells her that, you know, nothing's changed. You should have chucked it all, started fresh someplace else, some new name, the works. And so we find out a little about Floyd and Susan here, his ex-wife, that apparently he left her is what it seemed like at this point. He told her to move on and get a new life. And she tells him it goes against the grain. I think loyalty should count for something. And you know, he's like, you're flogging a dead horse, Suze. It's over. You're now, ain't you? Not because of you, I'm not. So Floyd, it seems he's lost his love for his wife, if he ever had any. But Susan, or Suze as he calls her, she seems very much in love with her ex-husband. I have known people like that. But that's another story entirely that I'm not going to get into. But Floyd, again, I don't know if it's he still loves his family or if it's just with Deadshot, it very well could be a sense of you don't fuck with mine or I'll fuck with you. Which fits with the tone because Suze is telling me how she believes in loyalty. And that very much could be just a sense of that's why Floyd's here is for loyalty for his family. Even though he doesn't really, maybe he doesn't seem to care about him anymore. You don't mess with family, so... And as Susan starts to break down crying because, you know, her son's gone and her ex-husband apparently knows something about what's going on, instead of comforting her and, you know, give her some love and support, he turns on her because, you know, she's like, for God's sake, tell me what's going on. He's like, I'll tell you what's going on. If you changed your name, changed your life, instead of wasting time and hoping I'd come back, Eddie would be here safe with you. Bye, Suze. And she's like, promise you'll bring her son? You gotta promise me, Floyd. And Floyd's like, I promise I'll deal with this my way. And as he says my way, again, I love this panel here. So you got Floyd just walking out of the house, shutting the door. And then an extreme close-up on his eyes and his face as he says, my way. Which tells us that these guys that took Floyd's son are going to be in a world of hurt because... He done messed with the wrong man, people. And then we cut to, as I say, we got Wes standing over Ed, just looking down at him. He says down, "Hello, you're a nice little boy, you know that?" And again, I'm adding the, because this guy looks very much like a redneck, backwoods, child molesting hillbilly. So, and that's kind of the voice I hear him speaking in. "Hello, you're a nice little boy, you know that?" And then I'm assuming it's his brother comes in here. "What you doing, Wes?" And he's like, "Wasn't doing nothing, Danny. Just saying hello was all." And Danny's all, "No, you do not just say hello. You understand me, Wes? You do not visit the little boy. You do not look at this little boy unless I say you can. You understand? You get it?" And Wes is like, "Sure, Danny. Whatever you say." Again, their relationship very much, you know, this book took place like 15, 20 years before. It reminded me very much of From Dusk Till Dawn with the Gecko brothers. While you'll... Quentin Tarantino's character, I forget his name now, he wasn't into little boys, but he did seem to like, you know, raping women and killing them and dismembering them. But their relationship seems very much like that of the Gecko brothers. Danny's very much the George Clooney character, the older brother looking out for his younger, I want to say dim-witted brother. And then Wes is very much the Quentin Tarantino, whereas, again, Quentin's character was, from what I could tell, into raping and killing and murdering and butchering women. Wes likes little boys. But it's that same dynamic that Danny is looking out for Wes, and he may get a little rough with him at times. He may have to, you know, just get his point across, but you can tell that he loves his brother. And I said I thought it was, they were brothers. Again, it confirms it here. As Danny chases Wes away, he says he promised Ma before she died he was going to get help for Wes, but he'll only do it if Wes does as Danny says. So again, I like this page here. Again, this one's not numbered. Page 5 and 6, the dynamic, the information we're getting about Wes and Danny here. Oster and Yale, they very much flesh out these two characters. Again, Oster, as I've been saying for the last 27 episodes, he's a great writer. Adding his wife, Kim, into the mix is just... I don't know. What do you take when you have awesome and you add more awesome to it? Awesome sauce, I guess. I don't know. But I guess enough praising and waxing John's car at this point. Let's go into the story here. Here at the bottom of page... what page number is this? Page 6. When Wes is saying goodbye to Eddie, little Ed, he's like, "Bye-bye, Eddie." I'm sorry. "Bye-bye, Eddie." the look on Ed's face, the next panel, he's got a close-up of his eyes and his face. You can see worry in it. Like, what the crap? and then as I talked about in the synopsis, Maureen Harris goes to the Lawton Estate, and it is an estate. This page here, apparently the Lawtons built this town. Had a lot to do with it. The train station has the lot name over it. And then we see the big house and then the little house I mentioned earlier. And there's a big gate. So Floyd's family has money. In fact, they don't just have money. They've got money. And as I talked about in the synopsis, Maureen meets Floyd's dad. And like all rich people, I mean, he's got the sheriff on his payroll, in quotes. We find out a bit later that the sheriff will do what Floyd wants within reason and maybe even beyond reason, but if he can, he's going to try to avoid doing any of that. But again, Floyd's dad, when Maureen says, you know, she's here, I'm your son's therapist and trying to get some information, he's like, "My sons are dead, both of them." And which is a surprise to, I guess, the reader and Marine, because this is the first time we're hearing that Floyd had a brother. And as the sheriff drives Marine away, he tells her at this point that, you know, at one time under a different administration, he may have shot her if the old man instructed him to. But Lawton still has enough clout that he shows up when he calls the sheriff, and he keeps trapped shut while he's with them. And I like this here on page 10. He's like, "These days, Mr. Lawton's getting old. If he doesn't see you again or hear of your name, he'll forget about you." And Reed's like, "Well, I need to find out this information. I'm not leaving until I do." And sheriff's like, "Figured as much. Seems the best way to get rid of you is to make sure you get your answers quick. Like a cup of coffee and some talk." So like he said, at one time, he may have killed her if older Floyd wanted him to. But nowadays, you know, it's easier just to get her out and give her the answer she needs. Which is very practical and, you know, very no-nonsense way about doing it. And then here on the next couple pages, Floyd's meeting with Philip Shell and Associates, attorneys. And, Shell thinks he's got everything under control. He's like, "You know what? As I said earlier, you kill me, the kid dies. Go looking for him, and I give him Uncle Wes." "Well, Floyd, what's your answer?" And Floyd's like, Put your hands palm down on the desk. And he's like, "Why should I?" And Floyd shoots right between his, because the guy, Shell's leaning back in his chair, he's got his arms, his hands interlocked around his head. He's like, "Why should I?" And Floyd just shoots right between his arms. Let him know he's not playing around. And Shell puts his hands on the desk, and I guess these top three panels here on the top of page 13. Shell's got his hands on the desk, and he's like, "What are you gonna do?" And we start off, Floyd's got his gun pointed right at Shell's head. Then he puts his fists on Shell's hands, it looks like. Maybe it's on the desk. And just blam, blam. Just shoots her right through the hands. And Floyd's like, "Got the answer? Do I need to repeat it?" And Shell's just like, "No." And we see blood smear on his desk where his hands were shot. And as Floyd walks out, he's like, "You're playing games with the wrong man. Pass it on." I thought that was I love this scene here where, you know, Floyd just, "You know what? Put your hands on the desk," but just shoots him right through the hand. You know, even though Shell's sitting there threatening his kid, Floyd's like, "You know what? You kill my kid, there's nothing to stop me from killing you." So, well, Floyd's very nonsensical about it, and that's who Floyd was. And then we get back to, as I covered in the synopsis, where Marine's finding out about Floyd's mama moved out of the regular house, moved into the small house. And again, this was written back in late 80s, and it's still true today. She's like, "You know, well, does that strike you unusual? The fact that Mr. and Mrs. Lawton didn't get divorced, she just moved out and doesn't talk to anyone." And she's like, "Well, does that strike you as unusual?" And the sheriff's like, "Yeah, but they're rich, and the rich are peculiar." But, you know, so I mean, I still think that's true today. I think the rich get away with things that the ordinary person wouldn't. And it's really, I don't want to say get away with things. I'm not talking about criminal wise, just they can do odd things and no one really thinks too much about it. And we find out here that Floyd's brother's name was Edward. So, and again, that tells us that, and I think, and maybe I'm looking at too much, I don't think so, but it kind of tells us that Floyd still loves his brother, no matter what happened in the past, because he named his kid. And again, I don't know if it was his idea or Susan's. Whose idea was to name the kid Ed? But his son's name's Eddie, which we can assume is short for Edward. So again, I'm taking the logical assumption, leap of assumption there, that he named his son after his dead brother. And we find out that, you know, again, as I talked about, Edward was the pretty boy. He was good at the books, the women, the school, everything, sports. And again, I like this. He's like, the sheriff's like, "Yeah, his name was Edward Robert Norton. Joke was the Lawton boys were the only ones in town that could afford three names. But yeah, these gives a little more information about Ed. And here at the bottom of the page, we find out he's like, Marine's like, was he actually dead or is he disowned like Floyd? Like, no, he's dead, all right. Actually, he was murdered. And so, and I like these pages here because they're talking in the diner. Every once in a while, we'll see other people in the diner just sitting there eating their dinner, going about their business, while Marine's finding out that Floyd had a brother that was murdered. Some sniper shot him. And we find out that the old man had the investigation squashed. And again, Marine's like, well, did you think Floyd did it? And the sheriff's like, don't know. I'll tell you this. Given the distance, it was a hell of a shot. And Floyd started calling himself what? When he put on a mask? Deadshot. So again, and that may be why the dad had the investigation squashed, is because, one, he's a very private individual. And for another, he probably knew his son was involved. So, again, being a very private man, he didn't want anyone else involved with the family, what he considers family business. And then we catch up with Shell in the hospital. His hands are all bandaged up from where Floyd shot him. And like this, he's telling him that they're going to move him to surgery, get a hold of Danny, and tell him to move him to the kid's alternate location. And like, tell him to turn loose the black sniper, that Panther guy. Which, again, I mean, especially now that Black Panther is really into prominence with the latest Avengers movie. I'm sorry, Captain America movie. And again, maybe it's just me reading too much into it, but I like this. He's like, and tell him to turn loose that black sniper, that Panther guy. Which to me, I see Black Panther when I read that, even though we know it's not. But apparently his name is Panther. And this associate, Andy, of Shell's, is like, but Panther will kill Lawton. Won't that upset our client? Tell the client. We're talking survival here. Just do as I tell you, damn it. And then here on the on page 21, when Floyd is confronting this lawyer, Andy, he's Shell's assistant. He's, Floyd's in his civilian identity, but he's got his wrist magnums on still. And he asks, this Andy guy, where are the kids being stashed? And Andy, right away, without hesitation, is like, Foreman Brothers Warehouse, corner of 8th in Kentucky. There's about 12 of them, including a sniper. Are you going to shoot me? And Floyd's like, depends on if I get the kid back and what shape he's in when I do. And he thinks about it for half a second. Of course, if I killed you right now, then I wouldn't have to worry about you trying to warn them, would I? Hey, kid, I'm going to borrow your wheels. Any objection? Didn't think so. So again, you get in Floyd's way, Floyd's going to put a bullet or two into you. And story ends on this next page where Wes and his brother and Danny are in the car. Sorry, Danny's the brother. Wes, Danny, and Ed. Sorry, little Ed are in the car leaving. Panther's on a catwalk or whatever up above. He's got like one of those yin-yang necklaces on, sunglasses. And as they pull away, Wes is looking at little Ed going, don't you be afraid, everything will be fine. What a nice boy you are. As he's stroking Ed's hair, next issue is entitled Victims. And again, that's the second issue of the Deadshot miniseries. Again, overall, I enjoyed it back when I read it back in the late 80s, early 90s. I don't remember if I picked this up off the newsstand or if I bought it individually. I've got it out. In fact, I'm reading this on my computer because it's easy to read, but I was looking at the actual issues out in the garage the other day with the rest of my books. I've got these pulled out. But as I was saying, I enjoyed these when I first read them so many years ago. I'm enjoying rereading them. In fact, I'm a little, I don't want to say disappointed that I'm already halfway through the series, because again, it was only 4 issues. I'll cover the next 2 issues next time, issues 3 and 4, and then we'll get back into our regular series, Checkmate Suicide Squad. But I guess that's going to do it for today. Like I said, I enjoyed the artwork. I enjoyed the writing. I think both John Ostrander and Kim Mio, I don't know how they split it up, if one did the actual writing, though it is the dialogue, or how they did it. But I would love to talk to John at some point and get his thoughts on it and his how their process. But for now, I just want to say that, again, this is a fantastic book. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed this series, in case you can't tell yet. And I guess I'll do it for this month. Join us next month, hopefully, when I return with issues 3 and 4 of Deadshot in our 29th episode of Task Force X. Until next time, remember, no one out crazies the Joker. See ya.
Thank you for listening to another great episode of Task Force X. I can also be found rambling on my main headcast of Ed Speaks, where I rant and rave about movies, comics, geek stuff, and whatever is bugging me.
Mate, you just out crazy the Joker.
Well, I try, Boomer, but anyways, my home on the internet is at headspeaks.com. HEADSPEAKS.com. Links to my blog, which contain follow-up information to this and every headcast, can be found there. Both Task Force X and Headspeaks are on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at headspeaks.com under Headcasts. Please feel free to email me any questions, comments, or concerns to taskforcex@headspeaks.com. And if you want to record a message, you can send it to me at taskforcex@headspeaks.com, and I'll play it on the air. I'm also on Facebook at Task Force X, and also on Google Plus, you can look for Task Force X under People and Pages. All titles and characters discussed are owned and copyrighted by DC Comics. I claim no ownership to the Suicide Squad, Checkmate, or Task Force X. I'm just a big fan, wanting to spread the Task Force X love with everyone else. DC Comics can be found on the web at dccomics.com. Be sure to visit your local comic shop and look for Suicide Squad and Checkmate Comics. And while you're there, see what else they have that may interest you.
Mother.
Well, make sure you join us here next time for another fun-filled headcast from your friendly neighborhood, Brotherhead. In the meantime, I'll see you in the funny pages.
Yahtzee!
Film and Water Podcast, a weekly show about movies old and new, hosted by obsessive movie nerd Rob Kelly and a rotating series of special guests. From sci-fi to horror, dramas to family films, comedies to adventure epics, we watch it all. The Film and Water Podcast is part of the Fire and Water family of podcasts, available weekly at fireandwaterpodcast.blogspot.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.